On the air everywhere, this is New England Broadcasting.
Welcome to the Ron Van Dam Show. Hold on tight, things can get a bit weird, if you like that sort of thing.
Come Monday, it'll be alright.
So good to me.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night. It's the Ron Van Dam Show.
Yes, it is. Welcome to the program. I am Ron Van Dam. I am. Look, I'm not in the mood to argue with you. Either you're going to accept that or not. You will. Thank you very much. This is like a police lineup where nobody chooses me. They choose everybody else in the police lineup, but not me. It's like the priest never had any interest in me sexually. I mean, like, what's wrong with me? Come on. Anyway, welcome to the program. Sit down, relax. I will take care of this. Oh, there's so much to take care of. There's a lot of responsibility on my shoulders. Also, a little bit of skin cancer. That's not good, is it? Is it? All right. I have a great guest today. Meryl Marco joins us. She's a writer, comedy writer. She actually was there at the inception of the David Letterman talk show thing through many of its various phases and times and conditions and all those things. She stuck with it and helped mold that legacy. And she even lived with Letterman for a period of time. So interesting stuff. We're going to talk to her today a little bit later in the program. Stick around for that. Get some insight on how that all came down. How it came down, man. Well, it's great to be with you. Here's the deal. This is, sounded like Biden again. Here's the deal. Oh, he says that all the time, but I kind of get it because I think I say it myself. Here's the deal. This is what's going to happen. I'm going to talk for an inordinate amount of time, and you're just going to listen, and I guarantee it'll be worth your while. It doesn't sound very attractive or very alluring. I understand that. I get it. I wouldn't listen to this either. But it's really going to be great. So trust me on this. But before we continue with the show, and I plan to do so, there are certain rules and regulations. I know. I get it. We don't like to. On the bottom of the screen, there's a little signature pad. And you have to sign it in order to listen to the program today. So please follow the rules and regulations as handed down to you from Moses, from coming from the top of the mountain.
Ron Van Dam is an experienced talk show host. Do not attempt to try this at home. Some listeners may experience nausea or vomiting while listening to this show. Yes. Please consult with your doctor or psychologist before listening to this program. The Ron Van Dam Show is not intended for listeners who have had a history of high blood pressure or acid reflux. Women who are pregnant should stay at least 20 feet away from the radio speaker and should avoid listening to the show for more than 2 hours at any one time.
Seriously.
The Ron Van Dam t-shirts should never be worn in conjunction with the Ron Van Dam pants,
never.
Unless it is after Memorial Day or before Labor Day.
But even then.
Yeah. Please refrain from loud conversation, as this may be disruptive to others nearby who are trying to listen to this program. Your enjoyment of the program may vary.
Yeah.
It may vary greatly.
Okay.
Please enjoy the show.
And now I'm going to show a little video with popcorn dancing around. This is like the intermission in a long movie. Did you ever see the movie The Ten Commandments? I could not sit through that. I got through two commandments, and then I walked out of the theater. It was so long, man. And Charlton Heston starring in a movie like that, and there were no guns involved. Odd, odd for Charlton. By the way, who names their kid Charlton? Is that a joke? Is that, were Charlton's parents like really like comedians too? And they said, hey, let's screw up this kid's life something bad. Either it's going to work for him and he's going to be famous, or he's going to beat the crap out of him in high school with that name. I don't believe Charlton was his real first name, because in those days they all changed their names from Bob to Joe. I don't know what his real name, you know, I could have Googled it before the show began, but to be honest with you, I do no prep for this. I didn't know I was going to say anything about Charlton Heston. Who would do that? The Ten Commandments, watch the movie sometimes. It's about 7 hours long. It's about as long as it takes to read the Bible. Charlton Heston starred in it. Man, wasn't it interesting that back in those days, nobody could act. Everybody overacted everything. They were just awful actors. Oh my God, they were awful. So awful that it's humorous now to watch. Anyway, a 7-hour movie, and it explains the Ten Commandments, and it's just ridiculous. So you got seas parting, you got bushes burning. I'm not sure I buy it, to be honest with you. I don't know who wrote that stuff. Who wrote the Bible, by the way? Was it a bunch of comedy writers who were sitting around a table in a conference room and said, let's put a book together and make everybody believe it? What do you think? I'm not sure. It was a marketing ploy. When I went to school for this, and I did, believe it or not, seriously, I did. I went to the School of Film and Television, New York University. Yeah. I went to college for this crap. And it certainly was... Anyway, I did, and they told me, be very, very careful when you talk about religion in public. And I thought, why? There's so much material there. And then I learned, I've been chastised a bit in my career for what they call religious humor to one is sacrilege to another. Interesting, isn't it? It's in the eyes of the beholder, I suppose. Behold this. It didn't work out too well. I think I don't think I've ever told the story on the air before, although it developed actually on the air. I was on a Boston area station, and it was back in the early 2000s, and this was around the time of the church scandal. The church scandal. When it became obvious that priests were molesting young kids in the choir. Not every priest, and not even most of them, but enough to make it horrible. And then in order to hide these disgustingly horrible crimes, the hierarchy of the church just moved the priests around so nobody would know what they were doing. They moved them to another parish. They'd parish them to another parish. As you know the story, why am I telling you this like you don't know it? But around that time, I was pissed. I was pissed because what I thought was if a citizen did this to a child, this rape and pillaging to a child in the guise of an organization, that person would be thrown in jail and slapped silly by the inmates. But somehow if the church does it, we'll just move you to another city. And I was pissed about it, man, because I live in America where things are supposed to be kind of equal. Not true, but at least you're supposed to try and make it look like it. So I said something on the air that I suppose I shouldn't have, or should I? I don't know. And this is what I said. I said, if a murderer or a rapist or a fellow priest went to confession, whatever that is, went to confession, and in the confession box confessed that they were committing this heinous crime, if the clergy person who was listening to this didn't tell the cops, hey, I just spoke to somebody who admitted that they murdered somebody, then that priest should be held as an accessory to a crime because they're not reporting it. And, of course, the answer is, well, it's like an attorney. If an attorney gets an admission from a client, you don't go tell. Well, this is not a client thing. This is not an attorney-client privilege. This is a church thing. I don't know if it's in the law or not, but it still pisses me off. So I said that on the air. Well, ladies and gentlemen, within 3 days, our radio station was inundated with letters from clergy people. And I remember being called into the office. I went in to do the show at 6 o'clock in the morning. And the general manager of the station called me into his office and sat me down and said, "Ron, I I'm on your side, but I got to tell you, the owners of the station are very concerned. You said something on the air. We actually received a petition from 28 area priests, parishes, demanding that you apologize and retract what you said on the air." And my response was, "Wow. People are listening?" That's my immediate response. Whoa, that's what? And my second response was, if I go on the air and apologize, then I'm bringing attention to what most people may have missed. Now everybody's going to hear this. And the general manager says, I know, it's absolutely ridiculous, but you know, we're a community. Every radio station serves a community. This is not good for us. Please go on the air and apologize." And I said, "Okay, sure I will." So that morning I went on the air and I brought up the situation, which probably would have passed with nobody even knowing it, but now I'm bringing it up and making a thing out of it. And I said, "I would like to apologize to those priests or people, and I apologize that they were offended by what I said." And that's the way I worded it. The next day I'm called into the office again by the general manager and says, "Well, you know, you said the apology, people get it, but we got phone calls again saying that you were just apologizing for their reaction and you weren't apologizing for what you said." So that morning I went on the air again. I said, "Look, there's some confusion here. I'm apologizing if I hurt anybody's feelings." Still not apologizing for what I said. Well, eventually the whole thing just went away and everything was fine. And I was never suspended or anything like that. But my God, the reaction, I mean, a signed letter from what, 13, 28, I have no idea, parishes around the Boston area. Give me a break, man. Wow. Fine. Anyway, my guest is Meryl Marco. She's going to join us momentarily. And we're going to find out what it's like to write comedy and to be so devoted to making people laugh. I mean, it's an honorable thing to do, man. I really think it is. I think it's one of the most socially responsible things you can do is to make somebody smile in the face of usual adversity. So we're going to speak to her right after this little commercial break.
Gentlemen, have you ever been in the mood for a nice knish or maybe bagel in the schmear, but you're also in the mood for some exotic dancing? You can't find those in the same place. Until now. I'm Moishe Kaufman, inviting you to come visit us at Moishe's Knish and Strippers, the area's first genuine kosher deli and titty bar. Come in and rock out with your locks out and check out our dancers. These girls are so nice, you'll plots, and they're all certified kosher. Maybe not the kind of girl you bring home to mother, but once you see Delia fold a dollar bill without using her hands, you won't care what mom thinks. Look, Bubby, you're in a strip club. That alone is enough to kill her, so live a little. Every Thursday, don't miss our buns and brisket buffet from noon to 6. Moishe's Knish and Strippers is closed on the Sabbath. Hey, we might be a little unorthodox, but we're not heathens.
Meryl Marco joins us now. She's a 4-time Emmy winner and former head writer for Late Night with David Letterman. And she's an icon in the comedy writing business. Great to have you here today, Meryl.
Well, thank you.
Pleasure. Now, you have a memoir. What's the difference between a memoir and a book?
Jeez. I really don't know, but I think it's because I wrote about myself.
There you go.
So okay. I think that makes it a memoir.
Okay. Is it, they're memories of you, I guess.
Well, they're not really memory. Yeah. They are memories of me. It's actually a study of memory, kind of. What I did was I... when I was cleaning out my office, which requires a lot of cleaning because I save a lot of really stupid stuff, I found all these little diaries I'd kept when I was in fourth, fifth, sixth through high school, actually. But it was the first three were really young, 10, 11, 12, and they had a lock and a key, and I was thinking to myself, geez, that's really funny. I mean, what was it that I was writing that was so important that I had to lock it up when I was 10?
Yeah.
So I thought... I would just sit down and read them like they were a piece of literature, and then maybe I was going to write a book review of them or something. And I started realizing that I only remembered about half of what I'd written. And also, because I was 10, 11, 12, I didn't really know what a diary was for. So I just sort of wrote down every single thing I did. And that was kind of amazing, that I had a window into another era, sort of moment by moment. And so I was thinking, actually, I would make a comic strip out of it. It would be a comic strip written by a kid in another era.
Yeah.
And then I turned it into something else, actually. It took years of figuring it out because I realized what the kid was writing was pretty random.
Uh-huh.
So I had to create a story arc and so forth. And also I started coping with the fact that I didn't really know who that kid was. She was so different from me. And also... that I didn't remember half of it. So it just became kind of an interesting thing, and I made a book out of it.
Interesting. Are you a New York woman?
No. I was born in New York, weirdly, and then I lived in New York for a part of the 80s, yeah. But I live in California and have since high school.
Interesting. Okay. Because you were a fixture in that area for quite some time, writing for... the David Letterman show in various capacities. How did that happen?
That happened because I met him. I was doing stand up at the Comedy Store, and I met him and became very involved with him. And he was getting opportunities to do a show, and I took over as the head writer
because
I understood what he was after, and we were very easy collaborators at that time.
Yeah.
So I just started. I saw it as an opportunity to, you know, it was, I had a lot of weird ideas and he was interested in weird ideas.
Yes,
so it was one of the few places that would say yes to these weird ideas. I had pitched them other places and nobody else wanted any part of them.
Yeah.
So it was a kind of a good situation for us both back in the beginning.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was nightly experimental television is what it was. And it was fascinating to see it develop over the years, going in different directions. And you're credited with coming up with some of those concepts that were award-winning.
Well, we were both preoccupied. I mean, I was living with him at the time, so we were like pretty much 100% preoccupied with that show and almost nothing else.
Yeah.
And coming up with stuff just kind of constantly. So I had done two other versions of the show with him before we ever got the one you're referring to on the air. We had done a afternoon show and a morning show. And,
I'm familiar with both.
So by the time we hit the air on the night show, we were up to speed on some level.
Yeah. No, you're right. The morning show especially was, they were all...
That was really experimental. That was crazy experimental.
It was. And it's kind of...
And got canceled.
And got canceled. And there's been nothing like it since that time of day. And I guess there was a reason. I don't know.
No, there was a reason for that. And then NBC executives were warning about me about that before we hit the air. They had me in for a meeting and explained to me what... women who watch TV in the morning, which is primarily who watch TV in the morning at that point, unlike now when every single person
watching
TV in the morning.
Correct.
They told me what women were looking for in a show in the morning, and I said to them, how do you know what women want? I'm the only woman here in this room. And, of course, I was completely wrong because I was just a weird woman, and they were reflecting what actual other women were wanting.
I know. Makes you wonder if that happened now, it would be probably a different outcome to the better, I would think.
I'm not sure.
Really?
You know, there's that whole other world of Kardashians and The Bachelor and stuff that get a ton of support are beloved, and I think it's I don't know if it's largely women or not. I don't really know who that audience is.
I'm not sure anymore, but I know things.
A bunch of my friends actually like that stuff a whole lot. So,
I guess. Well, you got to choose differently. Now, some of those. Did you and David come up with the concept, the Stupid Petricks, top 10, all that?
I came up with Stupid Petricks, but that was because what our task was, and we were preoccupied by. Continually was just things that you could what became an obstacle immediately, and you instantly knew was real was the fact that it was a refillable container every single day. Mm-hmm. So if you had something that you had completed one day, that was just the tip of the iceberg of what your obligations were for the week. Yeah. You know, you had something tomorrow, many points in the show, and then the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and then next week, and then so you had to keep. Moving those markers out, and given that circumstance, you wanted something that you could say, let's do another one.
Yeah.
So that was the hunt for things that were refillable, is what we were calling them. It was kind of like putting out a daily newspaper when you do a strip show.
Yeah, I mean, I remember I
once had Jimmy Breslin, took Dave and I around the New York Daily News when Jimmy Breslin was like a legendary journalist at the time, and he took us around, and I remember he said to me, and it was the only time this ever occurred to me, you know, they don't know what to put in the paper every day. Every day it's blanks, like what, there's not news every day, so you have to have things that fill up the paper, and that was really the case with the show. So when I thought of Stupid Petricks, it seemed like a thing you could do many of, and then that led to also, okay, well, what about Stupid Human Tricks?
Right.
Because that's the same thing, only different.
Right.
You could fill up a lot of time with that.
A
and then
lot.
I thought also of Stupid Baby Tricks, but we thought that would lead to child abuse. Well, I mean, really, it would lead to child
Probably
abuse
would.
If people endangering their kids to get on TV for 3 minutes.
I guess there's a limit to everything. I mean, you know, it seems like, and from what I've read, it seems like, it looked like a lot of fun, but was there ever any satisfaction in that was a great show? Or was it like immediate, like, nope, I got to top at the next one. No, I got to top at the next one. Go on.
He's a continually unpleasable quantity, Dave is. So it was never a joyous, satisfying experience. For me, I always felt that we were on the verge of failing.
Yeah.
Because we had gotten canceled in the morning. He was living with an axe over his head all the time. I worked with him. You know, he always felt we hadn't done enough, we hadn't done it good enough, we hadn't done it funny enough, we were about to get canceled. And I couldn't argue with him about that because we had gotten canceled once, so I didn't know. So I really never felt we were succeeding until years later when people kept telling me how much they liked the show.
Yeah.
That was the first I heard of it.
It's cool. Yeah, I mean, the book kind of goes back into your childhood and kind of explains what happened here. Now, how you ended up in this crazy business.
Well, it doesn't go as far as the Letterman show. It only goes through high school.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
I don't take you to my current life. So,
it's a look back to see how you got to wherever you may be at this time. What are you doing now, Meryl?
Writing and draw. Actually, you know, I've been doing some cartoons, but I'm really just sort of doing book PR right now. It's been the COVID days, and I haven't really got anything going on exactly.
Yeah. Well, nobody
so
does.
I'm
nobody
probably does. Start something pretty soon because I live for creative stuff.
Yeah, it's hard to stop the flow sometimes, I guess. That's right.
No, I love it. I mean, I like having a project to wake up to in the morning, so it takes a certain degree of quiet for me to go, okay, let's get going.
Yeah. One more question. What happened in your childhood that put you into this direction of comedy? It's not normal.
I just everybody I know who is compulsively funny started way young. You know, you find what cards you can play when you're a kid.
Yeah.
If you're the prettiest kid in the class, you find that there's power to that.
Yeah.
And if you're a kid who can make people laugh, then you find there's power to that. You play the card you dealt. You know,
you
if you're the athlete, then you find there's power to that. So kids stumble into it pretty quickly, and it has to do with, I think it has to do with problematic parents, but who doesn't have problematic parents? Not everybody turns out to play the funny card. It's just all the women I know, and I know nothing but funny women, and all the funny women I know had severe mother problems. But then a lot of funny men I know had big mother problems too. So, you know, on the other hand, who doesn't have big mother problems?
And well, everybody does. It depends on how you
Yeah, but
you
not everybody turns out funny. So,
yeah, I know. It's interesting. You know, I mean, my opinion is that there are two kinds of people. People that see everything and beyond it, and other people walk around with blinders. And it's both a curse to analyze, see everything, pick everything up, pick on everything, and it's a curse, and it's also a blessing, because it's like,
well, I love it.
Yeah,
I truly love it. Mm-hmm. I love seeing the world as a jigsaw puzzle full of pieces that you can analyze.
Yeah, it's just your brain works overtime is the problem. You got to every once in a while I have to say to myself, all right, calm down. Can you rest? Can you ever like stop that brain from working?
Well, that's why I love the creative process so much, is that, you know, what could be better than using everything you see as a piece and something that you're going to make? It's the greatest gift. I guess
I
my book, actually, by the end of it, is kind of a love poem to that, because that's the thing I feel like saved my life, is just the fact, as soon as you start looking at all those pieces and you reorganize them as a creative thing by you, you've put yourself in the driver's seat of stuff that you are not driving, and it's fantastic.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's great. It's like walking to somebody's house and there's no furniture. That's a weird thing to me. Okay.
Sort of.
Maybe. The book is called We Saw Scenery, The Early Diaries of Meryl Marco. And it's on sale right now everywhere.
And I have a question for you. How old were you when you realized that voice was going to move you forward?
I did radio shows in my bedroom.
There you go.
And I had a speaker in the window so the neighborhood could hear me. Cops never showed up, so I don't know why not. But yeah, you're right. It was if you're inclined to do that, you're doing it anyway. It's interesting.
Well, you realized that voice showed up and you went, "Wow, I've got one of those voices," right?
I guess. I mean, it's like you. I just I used to do little shows in the driveway. I'd have the neighbors come over and sit in chairs in the driveway in front of the garage, and I would do a little show. I mean, they thought there was something wrong with me, but you're absolutely right. It was charted from birth, practically. It's interesting.
Well, that was what was interesting to me about reading the diaries, is I realized I was inexorably headed toward television.
Mm-hmm.
By passion from a very young age, and I hadn't really thought about that. I didn't really know how I wound up there, but I was going there since young.
Yeah, no one has to ask you what you want to be when you grow up. I'm doing it now as a child, and it's not even. I'm already doing it. Yeah.
Yeah, but you got a really big voice.
No,
you know,
thank you.
Was a part that must have been a felt great when it showed up.
I guess so. I do. Yeah. I mean, sometimes I have to be a little more introspective and figure all this out, but you're right. I mean, We Saw Scenery, The Early Diaries of Meryl Marco. It's a pleasure. Is there some way people can follow you or check up on you and make sure you're okay?
Oh, yeah, I'm on Twitter. I'm on Twitter way too much. I'm on Facebook, too, but I'm on Facebook way less.
Yeah.
Because I'm mad at Mark Zuckerberg, but I'm on Twitter way too much.
We all are. I consider an achievement when I don't go on it for a period of time and I brag about it. So I guess that's the same thing.
There you go.
Thank you so much. Well, there you have it. Thank you so much for being the person that you are. Thank you, Meryl, for giving us the time. I'll be back again tomorrow with a brand new show. I'm going to talk about different stuff and use different words and actually vary my punctuation marks. It's going to be so different, you won't even know. You won't even know what's going on. Things will be happening, you won't even realize what's going on. Have yourselves a wonderful, wonderful day. Please vote vote, vote. Until next time, I wish you peace.